Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by Dr. Tracy Lopeman, Superintendent of Maricopa Unified School District. Welcome, Tracy.
Good morning.
And Brian Garcia, Vice President of the Tempe Union High School District. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thank you for having us.
It's back to school season for a lot of folks. But Tracy, you've been back for a while now because you're on the modified calendar. When did school start in Maricopa?
School started on July 22nd in Maricopa. So this we're in our fourth week, midterms, basically.
That happens fast, right? Brian, how about you? What's the world look like through the lens of school and Tempe Union these days?
I mean, our students went back to class last week, and we're in full force this week and getting everyone used to, you know, all of our academics and getting everyone auditions ready for their activities and sports. I'm ready to rock and roll, so.
Fabulous. I've really been looking forward to this conversation because education is something that touches so many lives in so many ways, many of them good. And a lot of times, especially with regard to Arizona's place in the national rankings of things like teacher salaries and number of students per classroom and things, we make headlines in a way that's less than ideal. We're often held up as an example of areas of struggle or areas of opportunity. And while we can certainly talk about those things, I think they're important. I'm also really looking forward to this conversation with two established leaders who have big commitments to making things work and really finding your way to help your staff, your teachers, your students really excel. So, Tracy, I'd love to just start with you. You're entering your 30th year in public education in Arizona. And you were telling me before we turned the mics on, you didn't grow up here, but you came for university and haven't left, more or less. Talk us through a little bit of your background and how you ended up in the position you're in now as superintendent of the Maricopa Unified School District.
Well, as you mentioned, I came here to go to NAU in 1985. And then at the end of that wonderful journey, I moved down to Phoenix to become a junior high teacher in the Alhambra Elementary School District, which is in the heart of Phoenix. And I had such an amazing experience there as a teacher, moved right into leadership within 5 years, and really enjoyed the impact I could have on really the tapestry of the district, of the school. And so I was in the Alhambra School District for 28 years and spent a lot of time as principal of Alhambra Traditional School, met a lot of great kids, a lot of great parents, made a lot of wonderful outcomes for kids all over the city, and then decided to go into district administration, a couple years of that in Alhambra, and then the opening occurred in Maricopa Unified, and I thought, wow, did a little research and tripled that wow, because Maricopa Unified was on the was at the point of restarting strategic planning, which was my specialty at the district office. Maricopa Unified is a growing district, which is very different from where I had come from, at least in the recent history. And there was so much opportunity in Maricopa Unified that I couldn't imagine being luckier than to be chosen to serve in the position of superintendent. And so that's what happened.
They're lucky to have you. Let's talk about some of those different phases along the way, because it seems to me, as something of an outsider, I mean, I certainly participated in my own way in education, but also a lot of folks in my family have worked in public school environments, school psychs, counselors, teachers, et cetera. Every one of those different roles you played along the way comes with its own set of challenges and unique opportunities. I mean, I remember my own seventh grade language arts teacher, Preston Beach, and playing a formative role as a little bit of a word nerd. I loved his class. I didn't do my homework. I got terrible grades, but I enjoyed being in an environment where learning was celebrated. As you move from there into administration, you work supporting principals and district leaders as you move into the district and now into the role of superintendent. Every one of those things brings a whole different outlook on what you're dealing with. Can you speak to some of those different roles and some of the challenges and opportunities that they presented to you?
I think that one of the roles that intensifies over the years is the chief accountability officer. You know, when you're a teacher, you are in charge of your students, your parents of those students in your classroom, and you have your world is small, and your impact is student by student, and so your accountability is clearly defined. When you become a school principal, you are accountable for, you know, in my case, 750 to 780 students every day. In addition to being accountable for reading levels and math levels, you know, you're responsible for stains in the ceiling tiles, the condition of the parking lot, what's going on with the monkey bars out there, and, oh, by the way, you know, why is the bus late? So, While many of the challenges that occur in your day or opportunities that occur in your day may not be of your making, they are your responsibility. And so that just expands with every role that you take in the education system. And that has certainly held true now in the role of superintendent. I mean, I'm further and further from the point of impact. You know, the point of impact is in that classroom with that teacher. That has not changed at all. They are the ones who make the weather in that classroom for every single child. So now my accountability, my role, my responsibility as a superintendent is creating conditions that allow that teacher to work his or her magic every single day, every single minute, as much as possible for every single kid. And I take that very seriously. I am accountable for the ceiling tiles, for the reading level, for the condition of the parking lot, and I need to be able to answer for that, you know, to every parent, to every board member, which I have an amazing board, who are parents. So it's just having the right people in place to, and being accountable for that, to make sure those teachers can do their job in the classroom, even though there's so many levels between me and that language arts teacher that I was 30 years ago. I've got to make sure she and those students in that classroom are my priority every day.
I love hearing that kind of commitment and that sense of ownership. Education is one of the things that lots of people have opinions about, very few of which opinions are tied to a commitment to do something differently. Certainly in the world, there's a lot of chatter and not a lot of, you know, putting one's tail on the line, as it were. And your district, although somewhat small, is still, as you say, growing and has unique challenges. Maricopa Unified currently has 6 elementary schools, 2 middle schools, Maricopa High School, and some charter schools. How many?
They're not associated with
right,
the district,
but in the area serving those same.
I think there's 4. Yeah,
4 serving the same area.
Serving
not
the
your,
same population.
Not your responsibility,
right,
but part of the mix of right, what education is in that area.
Part of the product that is available in Maricopa, the city of Maricopa. Exactly.
Tempe Union is a much larger situation here. Talk to us a little bit about the district itself.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, for me, Tempe Union has a really part of my heart. And just because I grew up there, I attended schools in the district. My brother just graduated from Tempe Union as well. And like I mentioned before we started, is that for me, education has been kind of a key piece of my life. I'm the first one in my family to graduate high school, go on, get a bachelor's, master's now, third year in law school. But the fact that my parents sacrificed a lot in order for me to be there kind of reflects the larger population of our students and our families. So Tempe Union is very diverse in its geographic and student population in addition to our family. So we have 7 high schools in the district serving about 13,000 students and, you know, ranging from a little piece of South Phoenix, Ahwatukee, West Chandler, all of Tempe, the Guadalupe community, Pascuayaki tribe, and the Gila River Indian community. And so We have a wide variety of needs geographically and also with our students. And Tempe Union is very unique in the sense that we have, like I said, that grand geographic area, but also at the same time being very specific to how are we tailoring our education needs to our to every single one of our students, whether you're a native student or whether you've been there for a while. You know, it just varies. But I think we've been doing a good job at kind of identifying those needs and very specializing it and tailoring it to each individual student.
You grew up in Guadalupe, but you went to school in Tempe and all the way through to ASU and beyond, right? Now, you must have a unique point of view, having been a product of the product, as well as now somebody who is working with the board to lead the district. What are your thoughts on what was your experience like and what's different or changing now?
Yeah, so for me, I mean, this is very personal. When looking at the board, I go back to my own family and how they essentially never felt comfortable going up to the principal or going up to, you know, the board itself and asking questions and saying, hey, I want this for my student. Mostly because they were both immigrants, my mom from El Salvador and my dad from the Pascuaki tribe in Mexico. And so for them, they were still learning English and, you know, trying to acclimate and figure out how do we navigate the system to best advocate for our son. And, you know, there are a lot of families like mine that have struggled through that. And as I grew up and, you know, lived through my own high school experience, college, you know, and eventually law school, is that there was never someone like me on the board that reflected my own experience or my own perspective and the challenges that I went through. I'm grateful for all my teachers. I mean, Mindy Udall, who was my campaign chair for the school board, she was my eighth grade social studies teacher.
Wow.
She was very aggressive in, you know, making sure we had everything we needed, but also went above and beyond to make sure that I had what I needed. In addition to Katie Garrick, who was my choir teacher in high school, Robin Palmer, who was my deck advisor and business teacher, and Patricia Ledoux, who helped in the yearbook. And these teachers were the ones who really invested in me to help me grow, even though my parents couldn't, because this is the first time that we were all trying to figure it out together. And so for me running, this was, like I said, very personal because I felt it was time to, if it wasn't me, who else would go up there and represent me and speak to the issues that, you know, not many folks have done it. And for me, my brother, like I mentioned, just graduated from high school in May. It's been a challenge because I've been trying to have him learn from his own experiences and learn about self-advocacy. So I've served essentially like a parent for him because I've gone through the experience and I know what it looks like and how to navigate it all. But it's just those dynamics that come to play. And when I first ran, you know, everyone kept saying, you know, you need to speak to only this group of individuals. I was like, no, like the point of this all is that we're representing our community and we're going to go to every part of the district that we need to, because this is our job. And it's funny because on our campaign little literature, I put on my own personal phone number and everyone's like, no, do not do that. You know, they're going to they won't stop calling you. And, you know, but the point is that we're accessible and that we're accountable to our community and that we're able to have that conversation when something comes up and for them to be comfortable. And one of the things is that I went door knocking to communities that haven't been involved in the process before, whether it was my own tribe in presence in Guadalupe or whether it was a piece in northern Tempe that, you know, is only Spanish-speaking community, to kind of explain to them what this all looks like and why their voices are important and how they can advocate for their student, but also how I can help them. And so it's been kind of a whirlwind because so many folks have felt empowered to be part of the process. And that's ultimately what you want to do, is you want to expand the electorate. You don't want to narrow down and disenfranchise people. And so I think over the course of the process, it's been something unique, not only to my family, but families like ours.
I couldn't agree more. I want to return to two things that you said, because I think they point us in the direction of a general awareness that many people may not have, that I think is important to bring to these conversations. And that is that the school systems, since the advent of compulsory education, have been places where immigrants and indigenous peoples both have felt a sense of unease. certainly in the case of Indian boarding schools, a forced presence, an assimilation potentially to the point of annihilation of a cultural reality that was you know, there's a really compelling and uncomfortably vivid story to be told there, right? And yet, I love the fact that you're talking about self-advocacy, which let's be honest, in an environment where the power relations are not working in your favor is a real challenge. It takes that, as you said, that initial moment of courage to even speak up at all for fear of some kind of, you know, if you don't feel like these people are on my side, and they may very well be on your side, but if you have the experience of being marginalized or disenfranchised or unable to speak up for yourself. So what you're speaking to here is a transformational process. Mm-hmm. This is not a simple slogan.
No.
This is not something like, hey guys, listen, all we got to do is start advocating for ourselves and we need our families to be speaking for their needs, et cetera, and everything's going to change. There's a lot of moving parts in an institutional environment. What are some of the initiatives that would make that kind of process of self-advocacy more effective for more people? What needs to be there in the environment for that to work?
So I think it's a few things, right? And one, right off the bat, is making sure that we're being authentic about our intentions and our efforts, because, and there's something that we say in Native nations and Native communities that we will want to understand where folks are coming from. And there's a lot of generational trauma because of the history that you just laid out for us, is that, you know, there's a big trust issue. Well, how can I go forward and say, you know, this is exactly what we're going to do, and we're going to treat your students well, we're going to prepare them for the future, all these things, but we're going to remove their culture. We're going to remove all these things that are inherently part of their identity. And that's troublesome, because that's, you know, what happened with our Indian boarding schools and the history behind that. But when we're talking about empowering them and engaging all of our communities, not just our Native communities, because, you know, there are folks in Ahwatukee too that have felt that the board hasn't reflected their needs either. And my job is to make sure that they're right there with us right along the process, that, you know, we're advocating for them too. But in particular with our Native students, you know, making sure that our staff and our teachers are aware of the cultural dynamics and the responsibilities. And one thing that I'm actually working on now is making sure that we're able to allow our Native students to wear cultural regalia at graduation. You know, all of our universities allow it. Why don't we? We're a little bit behind the times, and I'll be the first to admit it. But that signals to our students that, you know, I'm accepted. I'm able to honor who I am. We get to honor everywhere else. But, you know, when it comes to our Native students, we've kind of left them a little bit behind. And when I was doing my rounds of visits to all of our schools, afterward, I got an email from one of my students. She said, hey, I'm a member of the Gila River Indian community. I'm getting ready to graduate. And I know I was just told that I'm not able to wear my regalia or even my Native stole that Gila River prepared, and also our Indian office prepared for her as well. And so she, and then her own regalia she had prepared on her own. And, you know, she was very upset that she wasn't able to wear it at graduation, and something honoring that her parents had sacrificed enough for her to even be there in that process, right? And that just hurt me, because, you know, granted, I was only, what, 4 months into the job, and how can I best advocate for the student, even though she's taking it upon herself because she felt comfortable reaching out to me. And now we're being cognizant about not just Native culture and Native communities, but just cultures across the board. I mean, we have a refugee population. We have, you know, immigrants from Irish backgrounds. We have immigrants, you know, from Latin American backgrounds. And so we have all these families that, you know, we should be respecting their culture and honoring them, because it isn't just about the student. I mean, it is about the student and the achievements that they've made, but the journey that the families have taken along with them.
Dr. Tracy Lopeman, Alhambra Elementary School District was a diverse district. Maricopa, also diverse, has some differences in the composition of that diversity. How would you compare, reacting a little bit to what Brian's speaking about, but also in your own experience, what does diversity mean these days in a very practical environment like the school, like the classroom? It's a word that we often bandy about as if it's significant in a way. I believe it is significant, but I'd love to talk more about the specificity of that. What can you say, first of all, to compare the two districts with regard to diversity? How are they diversely different?
The two districts are quite different in terms of diversity, because the Caucasian population in Maricopa is much greater than the Caucasian population in Alhambra Elementary School District. It was probably 90% Hispanic, close to, and then has a significant refugee population. And so that, you know, we are not experiencing that to the same degree in Maricopa. And Maricopa is much wealthier in terms of its, every population is wealthier in Maricopa than the was common in Alhambra. So, you know, I think Maricopa is much more diverse in that sense, because there's more ethnic diversity, the representation of the indigenous peoples there, the white population, the Hispanic population. And then when you have, when you add a significant presence of foster children, homeless children, and then again the economic diversity is very apparent. So when Brian speaks to our responsibility, our second goal in Maricopa Unified is 100% access and equity for every kid. That's 100% to access and equity in great resources, excellent programming, you know, which means great teachers and great equipment, technology, the classrooms. Everything needs to be first class for every single kid in that district. And that is, if you don't state it, it goes by the wayside. It becomes less relevant. It doesn't become part of your daily function to make sure every kid has a teacher who's trained in certain, you know, methodologies that will support every kid at every level. So diversity takes as many faces as there are in the district. I mean, that's over 7,400 in Maricopa.
So you mentioned something there that I think is also really important for people to understand, and that is, as education tries to reform itself, and as new generations of leaders bring new concern and attention to some of the details, at the same time, the question of the training and the background of the teaching staff and of the administration is, in a way, a kind of debt still carried forward from the past. Not everybody has been trained in the kind of methodologies that are now acknowledged to be leading edge. And this makes leadership development and professional development, which I know, Dr. Lopman, is central to some of your academic experience, makes it a really big deal. Because the assumption, and of course you saw this with Common Core, the assumption that you could simply hand a group of trained professionals a new set of materials and expect everything to change overnight, when the reality of it is they might have 20 years of worksheets designed for other curricula, and there's practical challenges, not just conceptual ones, in beginning to teach differently or lead differently or advise differently. How do you deal with that? With all of the need to upgrade the capabilities of your leaders and of your teachers, not just of your students?
You're right. There is definitely kind of this contrast that exists when we talk about our staff and what they come prepared to do. You know, I spent 13 years at a traditional school, you know, and teachers had been using the same worksheet since 1987, and it was time to do the spider unit because it was October. And it's like, well, that has zero relevance to October or to the kids sitting in front of you.
Or to spiders.
Or to spiders.
Spiders, I mean, don't
it's
care.
It's not part of our standards anymore, you know? So that's why And therein lies the role of accountability as well, and being present in the classrooms and equipping leaders with what it takes for them to hold teachers accountable as well. But assessing what teachers arrive with is important. And, you know, you may get a 22, 23-year-old teacher fresh out of college who just isn't ready for the stress and challenges that some kids are bringing to school every day. So it is incumbent upon us to prepare them with trauma-informed instruction, Kagan cooperative learning strategies, thinking maps for kids that don't come with this pre-wired appreciation for literature and writing. We need to give them a formula, just like we give them in math. We need to give them a formula to learn to appreciate reading and writing, because it those may not be the conversations they're having around the dinner table. I believe the Common Core standards equip teachers to do that. And I think the Arizona College and Career Readiness Standards level the playing field for kids who don't come from a background where the conversation around the dinner table is comparing two novels or comparing two articles, or that's what the standards equip teachers to put in front of kids. No longer are they circling the noun and underlining the verb. That's sidelines. They're having much more academic conversations, using academic vocabulary, comparing a lot more, talking about different ways to get an answer to a math problem, because that's what we need to prepare our students for. And that's why I'm, today in education, we're very forward thinking regarding those new standards, because they level the playing field for every kid.
It's fascinating to me as a student of history and human culture and the diversity of our experience as a species on this planet, that we've gotten ourselves into a situation where these challenges are so great because we are serving so many and in such unique and changing environments. I mean, as you said, the need to equip teachers with modalities of social and emotional support for students whose lives are being disrupted by phenomena well outside of your control, whether they're the tragedies that make it into the headlines, which are truly horrific, and create a whole new sense of responsibility to protect vulnerable populations, or whether it's the foaming at the mouth political rhetoric on, frankly, all sides, which creates an environment of inhospitability, regardless, of what your personal political allegiances are, you will find yourself in a place where it's an unfriendly environment at some level or another. And you're trying to do a Herculean thing, which is essentially hold back the ocean, which of course you can only do so much of, a campus like a country has what was it, Jefferson or somebody, I probably failed history class too, who talked about that trade-off between security and freedom. I mean, if you were to do the things you needed to do to absolutely protect that space from some of the very real threats that exist unfortunately in contemporary society, you would also eradicate some of the openness and free exchange that's so necessary for the learning process. I mean, I don't envy what you're trying to do at all, and yet I'm admirable of the fact that you're committed to doing it. Does that make sense? I don't want to be in your role. No offense, Brian. Let's speak at the level of the district itself. You might have a little more freedom to talk about some of these things. What is the role of the governing board for the district, and how do you support administrators, teachers, and students in kind of navigating these very difficult times?
Yeah, so I think, the role of a board member is drastically changing based off of the needs of our community and just, being receptive and understanding what's going on. So I look at it a few different ways. So one, I look at it as our board obligations and our board duties. What's inherently part of the process in terms of our legal a standard. So, you know, we...
Federal and state.
Federal and state,
two sets of laws that
you
have to abide by.
Yeah. And so we need to understand, you know, how those interwork with each other, which is what I love, because I love jurisdictional mazes, especially when you throw in, you know, other issues in there. But in particular, you know, we're looking at, you know, our budgets and how we operate that, and our employees, and making sure our teachers and our staff have what they need. We set the vision and the policy and how we're going to allow, you know, the superintendent to have the authority and empowering our superintendent to implement that. And also hiring superintendent. And then, you know, school boards have also the authority to build new schools. And, you know, there's just a wide range of things that we look at that's very hyper-focused on our students. So that's kind of our legal board generalized obligation that some folks are just like, I don't know how you go about doing that. The second piece that I like to bring up is our community obligations and roles. Even though I'm not in a campaign year, I'm still knocking on doors, talking with our families, because our job doesn't end at the ballot box if we win or not, right? We're going to continue regardless. And even in Tempe Elementary, we had one of the board members that ran and lost, and he's still knocking on doors and talking with folks because he wants to help in some way or format. And so meeting families where they are is really what I'm trying to push, because our families are working 2 to 3, 4 jobs, right? And just trying to make ends meet and put food on the table. But also looking at how can we build community partnerships and really enhance our students' experience, but also our, you know, educators' environments and what they're teaching in, making sure that they have what they need in the classroom, whether it's supplies or even if it's desks, right? Enough desks. And then, you know, the board also has the authority to say, hey, community, we need your help and support in doing bonds and overrides, because right now this legislature and the governor are not giving us what we need. And that's kind of the struggle that we're facing. And so I also get to have a political hat when I'm not wearing my board role and go advocate at the Capitol and say, hey, and luckily we're half fortunate, really great, legislators that are willing to have that conversation with us. But there's so much that goes into it, because while we're trying to make sure that all of our schools and our students have what they need, we're still trying to take care of our families and meeting them where they are. I mean, we're dealing with homelessness. You know, how do we make sure that we're still providing education for them? We had a refugee student come in and we're having some challenges, but how do we address that? Do we have the cultural competency to do that? Unfortunately, we've had a number of student suicides in the past year from one school alone. And, you know, how are we being mindful of our social and emotional wellness for all of our students? And we've been creative in, you know, putting in mandatory training for our educators to identify what those points are when a student feels like they're going to be in that point of their lives that they don't, you know, want to commit suicide. And so, but also empowering our educators to feel like they can do that. And so we've created mindfulness rooms. We've really honed in on our theme of building relationships with our students. Because as I mentioned earlier, I really had a personal relationship with my teachers, and that's what empowered me to keep going in my journey. And so it's a whole host of things that we have to keep our mind on and just be mindful of our different communities and our parents and our students. But at the end of the day, you know, how are we best being strategic long-term to make sure that the legislature at the end of the day is giving us the funds that we need. And I will give a quick shout out to Kathy Hoffman as our, you know, state superintendent, because she has been driving that message through and through. And it's very nice to see, and it's really refreshing to see.
Dr. Lobman, in your previous role at Alhambra Elementary School District, at the district level, you were also working directly on some of these issues out of the superintendent's office as the executive director of Strategic Alliances and Government Relations. Mm-hmm. That is a long title that speaks to, again, a monumental set of tasks and responsibilities. Talk a little bit about that role of advocating up, trying to create the environment at the state level for the work that needs to get done at the district level. What are the issues? What are the challenges? And how do you engage in that work?
It's kind of a simple answer to say that the one of the primary challenges is funding. But engaging in the work is about relationships. It's about showing up. It's about speaking to a cause larger than ourselves. One of the initiatives that I worked very personally on in Alhambra was the Family Resource Center, because there was significant need for our refugee population and really just a community that was under-resourced. So being able to speak about an immunization clinic that we wanted to start in that facility, the types of services that we wanted to provide the community through that facility, when you have that kind of need matched with that kind of passion and you start to share that, you find out that a lot of people are very willing to help. You have a lot of advocates, and whether that's the Arizona Community Foundation or GCU or city partnerships, that was a very relevant and real experience for me that I've brought to Maricopa. And in Maricopa, we're noticing willingness to support our vision, what we see for kids, this ominous, important, this close to impossible accomplishments that we want to make every day. We know that we have lots of backing in Maricopa and in Pinal County. And sometimes I think some of the people I talk to know that it's not popular. Pinal County politically is very different than Alhambra Elementary School District, you know, on 19th Avenue and Camelback. So people are willing to support you anyway. And that's what I've realized in Maricopa, is that when you talk about the needs of kids and when you talk about the dreams of kids, and when I talk about the West Point cadets that we've had graduate from our high school, our Flynn scholar this mm-hmm. year, when he speaks to the impact of his teachers, he talks about the fact that this would not have happened if I didn't have teachers at every level, you know, supporting me, expecting, demanding of me. He talks about his high school counselor who put different opportunities in front of him at every single turn. And when you have those kinds of success stories and those kinds of unlikely heroes emerge from that work, that's all you have to do is say, hey, I give tours every other Thursday. Come meet some kids at Maricopa High School. And it works. They get to meet the kids in the DECA program, in our CTE programs, like I said, in our Air Force ROTC programs. When I get them to the middle school to look at the blended programs, you know, just meeting the kids and they can sell it themselves. And it no longer becomes a need and a drain. It becomes an opportunity and an absolute firework that people want to be a part of.
There's certainly been a number of standout successes in your tenure. You're entering your second year. Is it a three-year term?
It's a three-year contract, yes.
Your district now leads the state in new National Board Certified Teachers. There's the expansion of the community preschool program, which I'd love to hear more about. And you mentioned earlier in opening this conversation that you came in at a time when the previous five-year strategic plan was essentially coming to an end and a new process needed to be put in place. And that was something that was you were excited about, given your own background and experience. How did you begin? As you entered this new role, obviously you had experience in a district superintendent's office, but this is a totally different set of challenges and opportunities to lead from the highest seat. How did you begin that strategic planning process? What was the work day in and day out to really begin to bring some of this vision to life?
First, I would probably correct you by saying I'm not really at the highest seat. I think I'm at, if we invert that pyramid, I'm seated at the very bottom, hoping to hold up a system.
Yeah. Well put. The weight of the pyramid is yeah, on your shoulders. Yes,
flipped.
I get it.
I realized that about my third day. So, but we took a cue from the Simon Sinek book, Start With Why. And so we started with the building, describing the Maricopa Y. And it was a year ago that we invited over 100 people to the district office, parents, teachers, students, administrators. We had city council representation. We had the mayor there. We had police representatives. So just other business folks there as well, so that we could craft the Maricopa Y before we even started talking about goals and action steps and budget and all that other stuff. We wanted to have a crystal clear picture of what was going to drive our work, the reason we were going to get out of bed in the morning. And that was really ultimately to create a premier education system and to do something like change the world. And that's what drives us every day, is remembering that we're here to do something big and important that I know Brian can speak to as well. So from there, that's when it got, once we had that crystallized and could celebrate that moment, then it got more practical and turned into goals and strategies and action steps. And so now we're in the practical phase of that, but routinely return to our why, return to the metrics that matter, that come out of that why, like graduation rate, like 100% access and equity, like competitive compensation, becoming a destination district, earning and keeping the community pride of Maricopa. So, and those are things that we can measure in different ways. And, that's how it started, and that's what propels us still today.
Brian, what are your thoughts on that same set of challenges for Tempe Union High School District? You've got things that must be measured. You've got leadership roles that must be nurtured and supported so that they're empowered to do the work they need to do at the district level, but then within individual schools as well. Is there a clarity of mission, purpose, why in Tempe Union? And if so, can you speak to that?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, one, I want to, you know, acknowledge all the work that Dr. Lohman has done, because that is completely innovative and just a wonderful effort to really do, make a blueprint for the rest of the state, right? Because we want to make sure we're acknowledging that and putting that effort into it. But for Tempe Union specifically, I mean, we've been, you know, we always evaluate our strategic goals and efforts and all these things, but the theme that carries throughout and really goes to, you know, the heart of our students is the standard of excellence. What does that mean? So when we're talking about the standard of excellence, yes, we mean academics. Yes, we mean extracurricular, sports, and, you know, all these things that make the experience for the student, you know, meaningful and what drives our educators at the end of the day. But also looking at, what does that mean? What does a success mean to our students? And that's very different to each student. It might mean that someone, you know, wants to go to college. Maybe someone wants to go to college but can't afford it, and so they have to take alternative means. Maybe they want to go to the military, or they want to go take a workforce program, or just go straight into work and start supporting their family. I mean, success looks very different to everyone. But what we want to make sure is that we're meeting a standard of excellence for everyone across the board. And we're building on those relationships, because those relationships will empower all of our educators to say, you know what, this is something that I really want to see, and I'm going to invest in my student, and I'm really going to push all these things that are very meaningful to me. And so what I've been trying to do is making sure that all of our educators feel comfortable in raising concerns and questions that will say, hey, you know what, this isn't working, but you know what, mate, we've been doing this for a while, it's trying to switch it up. And the one thing that I tell the rest of my board members and our superintendent is, when there's a rationale that says, oh, well, we've always done it this way, well, guess what? That's not good enough.
Definitely not good enough, especially when we're living into a future, yes, where in 15 years' time, 90% of the jobs have not yet been thought of.
Exactly.
We're designing for, educating for a future. All futures are unknown,
yeah,
and maybe unknowable. But given the speed of technological innovation, the rapid changes in the workforce and associated modes of production,
yeah,
it's the old-fashioned Marxist in me coming out, there's a very real sense,
yes,
in which we've got to be preparing these students for a future we are incapable of not only knowing, but navigating in.
Yeah.
The degree to which we, and I'm only 45, but the degree to which we will be outdated so fast is stunning.
Yeah.
And yet you spoke to something really, I think, important, which is there was a time when this was a little easier because at least in certain socioeconomic and ethnic groups, there was much more clearly defined blueprint of what a career path would look like.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly wasn't universal.
Yeah.
It was presented that way.
Yeah.
But it wasn't in any shape or form universal at the time. But if you were a white middle-class kid going to the right kind of school and you were probably going to go to the right kind of college and then get the right kind of job— Now, the proliferation of pathways, some of which were always there, but now that they are not only available, but in some cases more compelling than that typical inherited view, that makes preparing today's students for tomorrow's needs and tomorrow's world a very different undertaking.
And I wouldn't,
which is exciting.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't even say tomorrow's needs, I'd say today's needs, because some of our students, you know, are already talking about neuroscience and neurotechnologies. And, you know, I went into one of our biotech classes and they were blowing my mind. I was like, I don't even know what this means. How can I support you to make sure that you're following in your journey and you know, getting all these things done? And I'm like, oh, don't worry about it. We've already got this taken care of, but we might need a little help on this part here and connecting with some internship. And we have a lot of organizations and nonprofits that are willing to come meet our students. And they're like, oh, come on in. One of our students was in a radiology lab and already trying to identify different forms of cancer and new upcoming technologies and all these things. And just the fact that they have that opportunity. And so for that student, it meant success that he was going to go off to college and become a neuroscientist in really looking at those opportunities. But for other students, he's like, you know, from especially from my experience, wanting to go and support their family because, you know, they don't have the money that needs to do it. So at the end of the day, it that standard of excellence looks very different to everyone else. And how do we individualize it? Because that's what we're going to create more of that empowerment and that drive for not only our educators, but our students and just the community at large.
There are huge swaths of this country that I really wish could wrap their heads around the fact that what's coming for your jobs is not another person.
No.
It's a robot or an algorithm. And in fact, that's already happening. If you work in HR, the clock is ticking.
Yep.
Anything that has a kind of large bodies of policies, procedures, and rules, an algorithm could do much more efficiently, much faster, and with a higher degree of accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
I just came back last week from a conference in Silicon Valley where it was in the media and advertising industry, but the level of what's already here in terms of deep learning algorithms, machine learning, the algorithmic processing of massive amounts of data, the world that we can't even be, that we still think that our smartphones are mind-blowing mm-hmm. technology, and they are compared to, you know, what we had 10 years ago, but the world that's already here in industries that these students are going to want to work in, entertainment, media, game production, software, but also into all other forms of ancillary services. It's not just the high-tech stuff. Mm-hmm. It really is going to be everything. When the last mile of delivery for purchases that you make creates a whole new, you know, nobody's going to the Circle K in 10 years. I mean, it's just already, that's already game over. So how do you lead an institution and a diverse set of people to wrap their heads around what's coming, what's now, as well as what's next. When, you know, we all, it's easy to pay lip service to things like STEM or STEAM or C-STEM, if you put the computer science in the beginning of this, of the science part. It's easy to acknowledge that that's important. It's a very different thing to execute on that reality when funding is needed, when upgrades to teacher training is needed, when equipment and all these other things, you know, and whole entire models of learning are needed. What do we do? Dr. Lopeman.
Right.
Why me?
I'll get back to you on that.
Yeah. We just like to lob the easy questions.
Right. Well, you know, I think what you're speaking to is the ellipsis, you know. Mm. We do need to teach content and facts. We do need to teach that. It's kind of like honoring the past. We also need to heavily emphasize critical thinking, problem solving and creativity, along with those other, what I think incorrectly termed soft skills, like perseverance and,
emotional intelligence.
All of those things that are really the skills that allow you to problem solve with someone, that allow you to be creative with a group, that allow you to arrive at a better outcome together than anyone ever could have alone. So that's really what it becomes about, is not being limited by what, by that October file, you know, that has the unit on spiders, not being limited by that, but being being inspired by what our kids are doing already, being inspired by the skills and interests that our students bring, whether that's culturally or geographically from where they're from, what their parents do. It's having that kind of an open nature as the teacher, instead of just being the sage on the stage, being a facilitator, you know, really being the match on that kindling, that to spark something that is undefined. We have to be comfortable with giving challenges and prompts that we don't know the answer to, and that's hard to grade. It's very time consuming, but that is our challenge. That is our challenge as educators. That's what drives us. That's why we get out of bed in the morning, is to see what our kids can come up with.
One of the biggest challenges in higher education, in colleges and universities, community colleges to elite institutions, is that as university education changes, project-based learning has become much more of a center part of the curriculum in every discipline. And what you have is a university faculty, 60 or 70% of which are now contingent, which means they're not full-time faculty, they're on contract. And that in itself has changed since the peak of higher education in 1965. They're now confronting the fact that not only were they not taught to teach, because a PhD is not often taught pedagogy, right? So they weren't taught to teach the old way. And now the demands of this more interactive, more open-ended, more project-based learning model requires a whole new way of thinking. And it gets very practical very fast. How do you grade an open-ended problem-solving challenge? And it's leading to all kinds of interesting things. Like, of course, for decades, there have been certain institutions where grades weren't assigned. But they were always kind of the weird, crunchy outliers. And now we're starting to grapple with the question, well, maybe they're onto something. Maybe there are other ways to measure success, as Brian was pointing to, in a career context. There's other ways to measure success in a learning context. But, you know, at the end of the day, we still have jobs and we still have responsibilities, and grades must be assigned and performance must be assessed, and teachers must be held accountable for results without in some way making this a horrible corporatized performance metric type environment. You know, there's got to be the good in all of it. What's the future hold, the near future hold? Not this grand vision I'm painting here, but what's on the horizon for Maricopa Unified School District? What are you working toward in the near term?
Well, along those lines, we are working on developing multiple paths to graduation so that we can capture the needs and the interests of a very diverse student population. We are advancing our partnerships with the city and with universities. In particular, we have a seed spot program in middle and high school in Maricopa, and that's social entrepreneurialism. And so we're very excited about that. We are also, as I said earlier, a growing district. It's very well known we're a growing district. So our the board voted to hold a bond election this November. So we are busy getting the facts out about the fact that our high school is currently about 400 to 500 students over capacity, and building a vision around what the next high school will look like, and capturing a lot of the concepts that we're talking about today. And you know, I want to be careful to not diminish the importance of math and engineering and architecture. Some of those things, you know, the bridge has to stay standing. And there's some, there's a set of truth and facts and reality and
structural math,
and physics, yeah,
yes, like
that
the old
will
Star
not
Trek.
Change. Yeah, like,
that, cannot change the laws of physics, exactly. Captain. Kind of a thing. Yes.
So please, you know, a complete sentence is a complete sentence. A great paragraph is a great paragraph. Period. I don't want to diminish that, but it's with those skills that we are able to. That's where the firework comes. Once we can be solid in those. And make sure that we're meeting the needs of every kid so that they can start to break the rules, you know, so they can have a one-word sentence, you know, so that they can drive a super cool car over that bridge that will not collapse, you know, a self-driving car, I should say. So the future of Maricopa Unified is developing those paths to graduation. It's investing in project-based learning at the middle and elementary level as well, developing our pre-K offering to include dual language programs in Spanish and Mandarin. Hopefully we have that starting next year. Because when people are on Zillow, and because they're going to move to Arizona, we want to make sure that when they see that great value in Maricopa, they recognize also the great value and the great programs that are offered in Maricopa Unified that will prepare their kids to be, fulfilled, capable, innovative, creative, successful citizens.
Very inspiring vision for sure. Brian Garcia, what does the near future hold for Tempe Union High School District?
So I get excited about this because this is, you know, one of the reasons why I ran is to, you know, help draft what the vision looks like and really challenge our community to think about it. So one thing is going back, one of the amazing authors that I love is Shonda Rhimes. She created How to Get Murder Scandal, Grey's Anatomy, all those great shows. She wrote a book called Year of Yes. And that Year of Yes challenges your inherent being of what you would stay in your comfort zone for. So, you know, let's say you feel comfortable swimming or doing all these things. Year of Yes challenges you to say, well, if I immediately say no to that, I should say yes because it challenges my mindset and how we're looking at things. And so I think that in of itself is inherent on how we're pushing forward our vision, because we as humans don't like change, even though we like to talk it and preach it and say, you know, this is good for us. But when the moment we get out of our comfort zone, it's, oh, this is a little uneasy and this is, you know, a gray area. How do we go about this? And so that in of itself drives our mindset and how we should look at things. So our standard, I feel like education has been very fixated on, you know, yes, on grades, and this is how we measure success. And the reality is that's how our funding is connected to and tied to performance. That's just the reality that we live in. But at the same time, that doesn't mean it's mutually exclusive to us making bold ideas and making sure that we are having that growth mindset. And one of the things that I've been focusing on is very simple, but kind of gets lost in the greater scheme of things. I mean, when we're making decisions about students, we're always thinking about them, all these things. But sometimes we miss the mark of actually going to them and asking them, what's going on? What would you like to see? We're here to support you and drive your ambitions and your passions. And that gets lost sometimes. And what I like to see is, you know, more of that engagement. Personally, I would like to see a student board member that either is there for a certain time or rotates between our schools. Granted, they won't be able to vote on anything because they're not publicly elected. But to still have that voice and their impact there, I think goes a long way. But also kind of leading on social-emotional wellness. We've had, like I mentioned before, a number of student suicides, and that just shakes the core of the community.
Yes.
And so how are we, one, responding to this? One, now we're realizing how we can be more proactive on this. And like I said, mentioned, we're doing mindfulness rooms, all these things. But we've created a partnership with the City of Tempe that is called Care 7. And Care 7 addresses the social-emotional wellness of our students. And we have one at each of our campuses. And while we're looking at counselor ratio and all these things, we're not really talking about the social emotional ratio and what that looks like. Because yes, you know, Arizona's counselor ratio is, you know, through the roof. We should have more of those to help more of our counselors to help us guide our students, but they can only do so much. I mean, their role is designed to help the academic course and their future course and what that measure of success looks like. But it doesn't, they're already bombarded with those responsibilities.
Then you add master scheduling.
And then, exactly.
And they're really underwater.
And then when you add in a student who just came out of the closet and says, hey, you're the only person I trust, or I'm thinking about, you know, harming someone else, or, you know, I'm going through this with my family. Where do you have someone that goes in there and says, you know, let's break this down. Let's talk about it. And so being cognizant on that and driving that effort to say, you know, we're going to be addressing all of our students and making sure that they have what they need emotionally. Because as you know, and social media just kind of amplified it throughout all of our communities. But, and the other thing to think about is, you know, while I love our educators and we're, you know, making sure we have competitive pay and we're creating great work environments and relationships so they advocate and empower for their classrooms, but also recognizing that we teach the way we were taught. And that in of itself goes to show, are we looking towards having this growth mindset or are we looking to have this fixed mindset? And, you know, going back to bold ideas, this is, you know, we shouldn't be in our comfort zone saying, you know, well, that's going to push the limit or our community won't like it. Well, the community trusted us to make these decisions. So we need to be pushing and recognizing all these things. I mean, we're looking forward to putting in a computer science program that's coming up at McClintock High School here in the next few years. We're looking at adding more languages to our course offerings. We're looking at building more partnerships, maybe even potentially with Waymo to help transport our students who don't have that transportation, right? And so they're all these options. And I mean, I know Nicola's heading over to Maricopa and, you know, their self-driving trucks are heading over there. And so that's an opportunity that Maricopa has. And so it's recognizing that there's all these things that, well, the traditional, yes, we'll have that as kind of our baseline, but we can always build on that. And that's, you know, the vision that Dr. Lopman and I have and share for not only our individual districts, but Arizona as a whole.
Education system is so embedded in everything that matters in our world. And it comes with no small set of challenges, but also with no shortage of deeply committed people who are really willing to live from service and to try to make a complicated and sometimes broken system work better for every student. Brian Garcia, Vice President on the Governing Board of the Tempe Union High School District. Dr. Tracy Lopman, Superintendent of Maricopa Unified School District. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.